Getting to work with college students is a privilege of mine. I've been doing it for 21 years now. When I graduated college, I started off as a high school teacher. Only did that for about 3 years before the Lord called me into full-time college ministry. And as I've aged in this ministry, I noticed one thing, particularly, that I miss the feeling of being indestructible. College students feel like they are indestructible. You just don't typically think about your mortality much at that age. There's too much on the horizon, too many dreams to realize. For me, this was a time when my faith was brand new. I had just met Jesus right before coming to college. And so I had no commitments. My faith was growing. I remember feeling at that age like I could do anything. I could go anywhere. I was reading stories of missionaries who would go and suffer for the Lord. And I, as morbid as that sounded, I was excited about maybe seeing the Lord take me wherever. I am long past college now. Plenty of commitments that you saw pictures of there in my life. I don't feel indestructible anymore. Got pretty bad knees, bad back sometimes. And I have felt like I'm growing more and more introspective, more reflective, a little nostalgic, a little sappy. You could probably get me to cry pretty easily just by showing me a picture of my ninth grade daughter when she was a little girl. You know, that kind of stuff makes me cry now when I see, you know, Google does that now. They throw pictures up of, hey, 12 years ago today, this is what's happening. And in the middle of my day, I start weeping at seeing my family that's grown up. I reminisce more. I step back. I like to see the world from 30,000 feet. And I like this. It's not a sad thing for me. I like this season of life, and mostly I get this kind of overwhelming sensation of gratitude. I feel like in my years on earth so far, I've been so privileged to see God work around me, oftentimes in spite of my own efforts. The places I've gone, gratitude wells up in me, even though I don't feel indestructible anymore. And I have witnessed that as people move through the seasons of life, this sense of introspection seems to grow, even especially maybe towards the end of life. Generally, as people are approaching the end of life, they want to gather those who are closest to them. Near them. They want to communicate love. Maybe they want to share some words that they've not said often enough. Maybe sometimes there's some regrets and just some assessment of the values of their life. It just seems like we gain a greater sense of what's important. And we have this filter to kind of filter out the things that aren't important anymore. Over the past 2 years, I lost two mentors in my life. Two mentors passed away. And so I got to experience them. And it was maybe the first time I saw that from a Christian perspective. I've seen many people in my life pass away, but these two felt like they were very close to me, and I got to watch them and interact with them through the final seasons of their life. And I remember two particular things. One man's name was Larry, and he actually kept a journal as he was dying of cancer, and he noted a few things, like how it was interesting to him that some of the worries of his life that he had always had since as long as he could remember, like paying bills and his schedule and his calendar and those type of things, he didn't think about those at all anymore. I remember thinking about how there's just this filter at the end of life. The other man's name was John, and he lived out in Missouri. He actually runs that Colorado program, and he was a mentor to me for a long time. And as he was dying, his family had like a celebration gathering while he was still alive, so that almost like a funeral, memorial service, but he was still around and able to enjoy hundreds of people that came to celebrate him. And I remember getting in line to greet him. What would become my last interaction with him. We had traveled 12 hours to go see him. And I got to the front of the line, and I remember this, I think, and hopefully I take this memory with me forever. But he wrapped me up, John did, and he had enough strength left to really hold tight. And as his face was here by mine, he whispered into my ear, and I remember the two really brief sentences he said, "Look at you, I'm proud of you. Look at you, I'm proud of you." And so on his final journey to heaven, he gave me a gift, some words of life that he spoke to me. We went through a series recently with H2O, with the ministry, looking at some of the last words that Jesus spoke when he was on earth. Again, with the idea that you really tend to hone in on someone as they approach the end. And this morning, we're going to look at an interaction that Jesus had shortly after the garden, when he was betrayed, when he was arrested. Judas gives him a kiss as a betrayal. A large crowd with swords and clubs surrounded him in the middle of the night. You had the chief priests, all the religious leaders. They brought him back to the home of the high priest. And this began some of the first stages of the trial, testimony, witnesses that they were all trying to gather in order to bring Jesus to his execution. So we're going to look at a few verses in the book of Mark together, again, towards the end of Jesus' life and some of his last words that he spoke on earth. So Mark chapter 14, starting in verse 53. As they took Jesus to the high priest's home, where the leading priests, the elders, and the teachers of religious law had gathered. Meanwhile, Peter followed him at a distance and went right into the high priest's courtyard. There he sat with the guards, warming himself by the fire. Inside, the leading priests and the entire high council were trying to find evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. But they couldn't find any. Many false witnesses spoke against him, but they contradicted each other. Finally, some men stood up and gave this false testimony. "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without human hands.' But even then, they didn't get their stories straight. Then the high priest stood up before the others and asked Jesus, 'Well, aren't you going to answer these charges? What do you have to say for yourself?' But Jesus was silent and made no reply. Then the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds of heaven.' And the high priest tore his clothing to show his horror and said, 'Why do we need other witnesses? You have all heard his blasphemy. What is your verdict?' 'Guilty,' they all cried. 'He deserves to die.' Then some of them began to spit at him, and they blindfolded him and beat him with their fists. 'Prophesy to us,' they jeered. And the guards slapped him as they took him away." So I want to make just a few observations about this encounter that's happening in the middle of the night. We have some reason to believe that actually what was happening there was illegal. A secret nighttime meeting with only a portion of the council. They're trying to find evidence against him, but they're struggling. Did you catch that? They were actually having a hard time putting together a case against Jesus. Even the false testimony, people that were willing to stand up and lie, they weren't finding that they could agree with each other, and they needed at least two testimonies that were in agreement. They were focusing in on some comments Jesus made about the temple, grasping for ways to get him to a path of execution. This is significant because as things were playing out, they did not have enough to keep him. He likely could have been released, but as they're talking amongst themselves, the high priest decides to turn his focus just to Jesus, who is just watching at this point, and he asks him directly, right? Maybe out of desperation, maybe looking for some way to trap Jesus. What do you have to say for yourself? And Jesus didn't even acknowledge that first question. He was waiting for the next question. And then more directly, the high priest asks, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? The Jewish people did not speak the name Yahweh. So the Blessed One was God, was Yahweh. Are you the Son of God? And Jesus gave a relatively short answer. There's two sentences. The first sentence was only two words, but it was enough. You saw it, that the atmosphere of that meeting changed drastically at that point. Some of the last words that Jesus spoke changed the entire course of that night. The meeting went from confusion, desperation, to horror and rage, spitting, beating, jeering, slapping. All you would have to do is look at the tone of that room to know that he said something profound. The high priest tore his robes in horror. The Old Testament, this was a sign of either grief or mourning, or the high priest was required by law, if he heard blasphemy, he was required to tear his clothing. They demanded guilty verdict, and they demanded death. So what did Jesus even say here? Right? Look at it again, the underlined part. He just said, I am. The answer is very, very affirmative. I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated in the place of power at God's right hand and coming on the clouds of heaven. So we don't need a degree in Old Testament theology to know that he is saying yes. He's saying yes here. I am the Messiah. It's what you say. But this is also packed with references and imagery that goes deeper than just the affirmative response. In a sense, Jesus crafted his answer here perfectly for that room, perfectly for that audience, so it would leave no doubt in their minds what he is saying here. First sentence, he says, I am. There's two Greek words here, the exact same two Greek words translated from the Hebrew when Moses was interacting with Yahweh. You may remember the first time these two words were used in this way in Exodus 3. Moses protested, if I go to the people of Israel and tell them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, they'll ask, what's his name? And what should I tell them? God replied to Moses, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel, I am, has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my eternal name, my name to remember for all generations. So the same words that God uses to Moses to say his name are the words that Jesus is using to answer the high priest. Jesus is calling himself God. The second sentence talks about the Son of Man, clouds of heaven and fire or power and those type of things. This also would have been very intentional, and everyone in the room would have known the vision of Daniel in Daniel chapter 7. A messianic prophecy that says, as my vision continued that night, I saw someone like a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient One and was led into his presence. He was given authority, honor, and sovereignty over all the nations of the world, so that people of every race and nation and language would obey him. His rule is eternal. It will never end. His kingdom will never be destroyed. So you notice in that prophecy of the Old Testament in the book of Daniel, both the humanity and the divinity of the one being spoken of here. This was definitely seen to those people as a prophecy of the coming Messiah, and Jesus was answering his question with a messianic prophecy. This isn't the first time that Jesus would use such clear words. It's consistent with how he talked with other people, oftentimes in small settings. He actually sort of he skirted around this question in other circumstances, but with a few people, he shared a similar message. Look at John 8. He was with a small group of people, and they said, "You aren't even 50 years old. How can you say you have seen Abraham?" Jesus answered, "I tell you the truth, before Abraham was even born, I am." Same two words. At that point, they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus was hidden from them and left the temple. Another spot with just one person, John chapter 4. This is the story H2O gets its name from. Jesus is interacting with the woman at the well, and she told him, "I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, I am he." Same two words in there. There are many other instances, small interactions. Jesus talks about his divinity or unity with the Father, or he does things that only God can do, like forgives people's sins, not to mention the miracles and raising people from the dead. But he would often try to keep these things under wraps. It's not only consistent with what he said about himself and what the religious leaders heard him say, but it's consistent with what his followers started to believe about him as they were with him, those closest with him, and what they would teach as the early church was formed and passed on. You've heard Paul in Colossians 2 say, "In him the whole fullness of the deity dwells in bodily form." In Philippians 2, "At the name of Jesus, every knee should bow. Every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord." So we must come to terms with the fact that Jesus claimed to be God. It's repeatedly in the words he spoke. His enemies believed that's what he was saying. Those closest to him believed this about him. And I like to pretend like I know his tone when he's in that room in the middle of the night with all the religious leaders and he gives his answer. I go back and forth from wanting his answer to be this calm, controlled answer that is power and control, to wanting it to be this force that actually knocks the people back as they realize just for a moment they're actually talking face to face with God, before their wonder turns to rage. In any event, he was direct. He was no longer vague. He was no longer in danger of crowds misunderstanding the Messiah and trying to make him king. Now, he was only in danger of losing his life. And with clarity and concision, and I believe some sense of power, he chose in this moment to die. And this is where we come to the crux of the Christian faith. Jesus was not simply a good moral teacher. Good moral teachers don't get executed. Everyone who knew him knew that he was claiming to be God. He leaves no room for us in our day and age to see him as a good man, a good moral teacher. I read a book in college called Mere Christianity, and C.S. Lewis made this argument famous that Jesus couldn't be, he could be a lot of things, but he could not be a good moral teacher. And Lewis says it much better than I do, like this: "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He's not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Now, it seems to me obvious that he is neither a lunatic nor a fiend, and consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God. It's a good book, by the way. It holds up. It's still good. So this is significant, and this actually sets Christianity apart from all other religion or worldview. No leader of any major religion throughout history has claimed to be God. Anyone that says all religions are basically the same is speaking out of ignorance. Christianity is fundamentally different, and it is with this point that all other religions focus primarily on the teachings of the founder, whereas Christianity focuses on the founder, on himself, who he is, who he was, and what he is qualified to do based on who he is. The fact that Jesus was both fully God and fully human qualified him to bring together the relationship between mankind and God that we once knew and that we all crave and long for in a broken and divided world. Without these last words of Jesus, these final words of his life, none of it has any bearing on our lives. What does this have to do with us? What does it mean to us that Jesus claimed to be God and is God? I think how we know what it means to us is seen in the response in that room that night. You ever think about this? Why were they so desperate to kill him? These religious, moral leaders were trying to craft false arguments. They were trying to craft lies that would line up to be able to kill Jesus. Why were they so desperate? He threatened a system in which they were thriving. They were comfortable. They were in control. They were seen as wise. They were admired and feared and respected. And though they taught about the coming Messiah, and it was part of their culture, it became evident to them that they were better off without one. If he is God, they knew it would change everything. And they took whatever action they could within their power to make sure that wouldn't happen. And it was threatening to them in the same way it's threatening to us today. Because a good moral teacher in the first century can make no demands on my life. It would be much easier for me to see him as just a good guy. But if he is God, it would change everything in our lives as well. In our lives where it may appear that we're in control. We might even be pretty comfortable. We might be thriving. We might feel wise. We might be respected by those around him. And it could change all of that. I think a lot of people reject Jesus, both back then and today. They reject this idea that he could be God because of the implications that that would have on their lives. And I actually have come to sort of respect the honesty and the authenticity of that, because I think actually more people seem to accept Jesus. We see this on campus, absolutely. People seem to accept Jesus, but it's on their terms. And he only has the level of authority in their lives as a good moral teacher. And so they try to live a good moral life. They might even go to church or come to a small group every once in a while. But the primary narrative in their lives is that they are in control. They have autonomy. The choices they make, the plans they make, the preferences they have remain their own. And Jesus, in this encounter, leaves absolutely no room for that option. If he is who he says he is, he rightfully deserves my allegiance, our obedience, our worship. If he is who he says he is, then what he endured for us shows just how precious we are to him. And if you are that precious to someone, it changes you. To be that precious to someone changes a person. If he is who he says he is, then who I really am is in his eyes. What he sees when he looks at me, that's who I am. If he is who he says he is, then who I am is not based on what I've done, what I look like, what I have and own, who I'm friends with, or even how I feel. Who I am rests only in the unchanging power of God. This is the gospel. This is the good news. These last words of Jesus spoke about who he was, and they speak to us today about who we are and how we might live in light of that. I leave you with just one verse where John says who you are, who we are, in light of who Jesus is. John 1:12 says, "Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God."